Accession number 19891, Reel 4.
Bill Adams, Reel 4.
At the end of the last reel, I was talking about the system of changing engines during the Irrawaddy crossing. The system worked beautifully, and we never had a single breakdown in the whole operation, whereas the unfortunate other units who put their outboard motors and propulsion units into the Remy workshops, constantly breaking down, constantly floating off to nowhere, endless trouble. Ken Sink was a most unusual chap. He was a South African, and South Africans, as you know, are not weren't very popular in India at that time. But the Juans absolutely loved him. He was a man who used the foulest language I've ever heard the whole time. And he used it so much that it almost became an endearment. And the Indian troops loved it when he swore at them. Whereas if I'd sworn at them and used such language, I'd have had a knife in my back within an hour or two. But Ken was immensely popular. And I can remember the Subedar coming to me one morning and saying, is Captain Sink's vibe all right? And I said, yes, as far as I know. And he said, well, he didn't swear at me this morning. But anyhow, that's by the way. He was a very fine mechanical engineer, but he wore the most unusual uniform, a sort of dirty light shirt, whereas we were all, because he was tinkering with the engines the whole time. And I was standing on the bank of the river, and the sapper colonel who was directing the whole operation, the Cagri, Colonel Murray, was with my CRE, and he suddenly pointed and said, what on earth is that man doing on that raft out there in the thing? And I looked out, and of course it was my raft which had come into view. It was out of sight most of the time, because the river was so wide that things disappeared as they were at water level. And I said, it's mine, it's my repair workshops. And there was a tremendous row as to why I hadn't been using the Remy workshops. But he never actually stopped me. And so we went on and did it for the whole operation.
And then?
After the first 4 or 5 days, it became rather a routine exercise, and we put across all the other vehicles in the Corps. I think we passed something like 20,000 vehicles over the river. And as I said, there were 10 field companies doing it. But they gradually went away with their divisions. And my company was one of the very last to go. It became an absolute routine operation, passing so many vehicles a day across this ferry. But then we were picked up and taken to Mike Tiller, and the work changed dramatically then, because we built bridges down the axis of advance, down to Pigou and Rangoon. And the form roughly was that you drove on until you came to an obstacle, and there'd be vehicles piling up, unable to get across a broken down bridge. There'd be a pile of Bailey, which had been airlifted by the side of the obstacle, and you just got down and built a bridge. And it normally took about a week to build. And when you'd built one, and traffic was going across it, you then went on until you got to the head of the column again and found another obstacle the same width. And it was absolutely fascinating building these bridges, because they were much bigger than sort of ordinary bridges in use. And we were talking about bridges when we had a short stop, and they were a fascinating technical problem, because the Bailey we were using had been made in America and not in England. And as a result, instead of using RSJs for the sections, they used channels. And so the equipment had different engineering properties to what the handbooks which we had did. And it became an interesting design problem to work out what you needed to make a bridge strong enough to take tank transporters. I was absolutely beaten by this. I'd forgotten all the engineering I'd learned at Cambridge, because it was now about 5 or 6 years ago, and I'd been doing really simple stuff. But luckily, and I had a subaltern who just finished a course at Lahore University, and so he got down and did the design for us. And the other problem was that there were continuous bridges which passed over piers. And the problem is that when you're launching a bridge, it has to go on rollers over the piers, and the stress is reverse until the bridge is in position. So you've got design criteria which you need during the launching period, which are quite different from what you can have when the bridge is finished. But luckily, this chap Prince was an ace man, and we got away with it. And they really were fascinating, some of the bridges we built, sometimes one pair, sometimes two pairs. And I think the only other theatre where they did this sort of thing was Italy. Where again they had the same problems, but there of course they had British Bailey and hadn't got to worry about the different engineering qualities of the American Bailey. They never told us, poor chaps at the sharp end of course, that we were using American Bailey. And at first we tried to design it as if it was British Bailey. And we eventually realized by some unfortunate accidents that there was something wrong. And someone then noticed that the construction was different. That's about all I can say about that.
What happened next?
It was quite amusing, actually. The bridges took us sometimes about a week to construct. And but during the week, a great queue of vehicles would form to cross. Sometimes it was about 7 miles long. When people saw that the bridge was just about to be complete, they then competed to get across first. And I can remember one bridge where four or five people said it was imperative that they went across first. And we gave the palm to a chap who said he was Lord Louis Mountbatten's ADC, when he quite obviously wasn't, you know. But we thought a chap who could tell such a barefaced lie would get somewhere, and we let him go first.
What happened after this?
Well, then we got down to Pigou, by that time Rangoon had been captured, so we used sort of civilian houses to billet in at Pigou, and we then went back strengthening bridges which had been a bit dicey, so the tank transporters could go freely across them. And this was much more solid construction we did, and sort of using as much timber in Burma's extremely strong teak and sheesham and various other woods. And we made some bridges which were absolutely sort of solid, could have taken class 100 if they'd been existing. And things had come ground to a sort of slight halt then, as Rangoon had been captured. And my CRE suggested I went back to India for had a week's leave. to see my wife off. I was going home. And so I went back. She was staying at a hotel in Dehradun. And I went back and spent a week with her. I took my orderly with me so that he could get some leave. And then came back. And when I got to Rangoon, there was no one to meet me, of course, because they didn't know I was coming. So I went down to the road to thumb a lift back to Pigou. And luckily, one of the other companies in our formation, a jeep of theirs passed. It was the Madras company. And the Madras, I sat next to the Madras driver in this jeep. And we went back to Pigou. But unfortunately, we'd gone about 20 miles. We went and skidded on some oil on the road. And the jeep overturned. And it overturned on top of me. I was at the bottom. And I broke a wrist. And luckily, an ambulance going the other way drew up at exactly the same moment. And the ambulance took me back to Rangoon, to the Lady Dufferin Hospital, I think it was, where they tried to set the wrist. And they had a go at it, and it wasn't any good. And so they had another go at it, and it wasn't any good. And the hospital hadn't got any water. It was an incredible shambles of a place. If you can imagine a hospital without water, it's really quite a sight. They decided to evacuate me to India to get the wrist set. And they took me up to the airport. And eventually a hospital plane came in. Dakota, and I got on it, and I was the only officer. There were about 20 other ranks, and they loaded the rest of the hospital plane up with sacks of arter. To our astonishment, we then went to where the battle was taking place on the Burma-Siamese border. And we dropped these sacks of arter out. We just pushed them out of the back of the plane. It was a lovely sight, actually, seeing the man standing by the open door, just pushing the sacks of arter out. And we had red cross markings, of course. We then went to Akiab, where they disembarked us. It was dark by then. And they took me to a hospital in Akiab, and we spent the night there. And then the next day we loaded up again, and it was a monsoon day, and the clouds were very thick. And we got up to about 12,000 feet, when suddenly everything went black, and there was a most tremendous roaring noise. Rather like a sort of lift sort of going down badly, and it was completely pitch black, and it rather felt as if one had chains across one's chest, and frankly I hadn't a clue what was happening. And suddenly we were flying normally again, and everything was all right. And I looked out of the window, and we were about that distance off the top of the trees in the jungle. And door of the cabin opened, and the the navigating officer, who is a pilot officer, sort of stumbled out. And he came straight to me, and he said, "Major, are you okay?" And I said, "Yes, but what was all that?" And he said, "We turned two complete somersaults like that, and we dropped 12,000 feet. And we'd been caught in a nimbocumulus cloud." And frankly, I hadn't known what was happening, so I didn't worry. And we then sort of flew normally. And when we got to Chittagong, they said, did we want to go on by plane to Calcutta, or would we rather go by train to Dhaka? And I said, well, I don't want to get caught in one of these things again. I'll go by train to Dhaka. And so I went to Dhaka, and they tried to set my wrist again, and they couldn't do it. And they tried again, and they couldn't do it. So they then took me back to Chittagong, and this time they evacuated me on a medical ship to Calcutta. And at Calcutta, we went into the Maharaja of Cooch Mahal's palace, which they were using as a sort of transit hospital. And it was rather fun because the Maharaja of Cooch Mahal had been a Trinity Hall the same term as me. But he didn't turn up there at all. And they didn't do anything there. And they then said, we'll send you by hospital train to Trimalgiri, which is in South India, near Secunderabad. And so we got on this train, and the journey took 2 days. And they jammed me up in the on a top bunk. And I'd got this wrist in a sling, and it was broken. And I couldn't get out of the bunk. And there were some nurses on it. And I realized very quickly that the nurses had been chosen for their social qualities rather than their medical qualities. And there wasn't much nursing done, if you know what I mean. And I stuck in this bunk upstairs practically until I got to Trimalgiri. And there they tried again to set it. It was an orthopedic hospital. And they didn't succeed. So there was a very, there was a proper orthopedic surgeon there. And he said, we'll have to operate on this thing. So they cut my wrist open and set it manually, if that is medically correct. And I was about 3 months in the hospital before they let me out. And they then wanted to send me to the RE depot. Heaven alone knows where it was, for somewhere in central India. But I said, no, I'm going back to my own depot in Roorkee. And I went back there. And as I passed through Delhi, I spent a night with a great friend of mine who was a G1 in Army headquarters. And he was staying at his a cousin's house, and his cousin was Lord Chief Justice of India, and so it was a pretty substantial house, and the room he gave me had a bath in it, and I thought, gracious, at last I'm going to, the Lord Chief Justice had gone on leave to England. And Bruce was bungalow watching for him. I thought I'm going to get a bath, but when I looked at it, I found the bath was not connected to any water supply of any sort, and they still heated the water up in samovars outside, even though the owner of the bungalow was Lord Chief Justice of India. But then I went back to Roorkee. And by that time, I'd been medically boarded, and I was very low medical category because my wrist wouldn't take any weight. And so they put me, and the war had ended by then. They made me OC. They put me in charge of demobilization and promoted me, and I became a sort of temporary lieutenant colonel. And I had the lovely job of organizing demobilization. And it really was fascinating because the commandant and myself and the corps subedar major and the jemadar clerk from orderly room interviewed every man in the Bengal sappers as they passed through us. And there were 20,000 of them. And every day we sort of did about 100. And every man came in front of the commandant, and the commandant asked him what he wanted to do. And if the chap said he wanted to go on serving, we said yes. And then we chose the people for demobilization. Agent service groups had nothing to do with it at all, because they all wanted to stay. And we first of all got rid of people who were medically unfit and discharged them. And then we discharged the few who wanted to go. There were a few. And then we had the problem of the GIFs. We had to grade the GIFs into black, grey and white. The black were the ones who had committed atrocities. The grey were the ones who were probably weak-minded had gone along with it. And the whites were the ones who'd resisted the Japs and hadn't joined Bose's army, the GIF army, the Indian National Army. Eventually there was a trial in the Red Fort in Delhi in which Pandit Nehru acted as lawyers for the defence of some really black GIF leaders, and three or four of my Jawans had to go down to the Red Fort to give evidence in their trial. The trial was finished, and they were found guilty, and they were sentenced to transportation for life, which means going to the prisons in the Andaman Islands. It had to go to the Commander-in-Chief for confirmation, and he decided, probably very rightly, that the sentence should be commutated to cashiering. In other words, they were dismissed from the army but were free. And while the trial had been going on, there was practically no other news in India. I can remember the Statesman, which was the Delhi paper, just being, the whole paper was word-to-word comment on the trials. It took the whole imagination in India. And when these people were freed, they went home to the Punjab, and so they caught the night frontier mail to Lahore. And when they arrived at Lahore in the morning, the biggest crowd that had ever assembled in the Punjab was there to meet them. From that moment, it was quite obvious that we were going to leave India. It stood out a mile. And my Jawans came back and reported to me, and they said, "Sahib, never again are we going to give evidence in a trial of that sort." And yet, if these people had been tried by a summary court martial in Singapore or somewhere like that, they would certainly have been found guilty and would have probably been shot on the spot. And if they had have been, we would probably still remained in India for very much longer.
What about these Bengal and Sapa miners' Jawans? How were they in a position to give evidence?
Well, they'd seen some of the things that these chaps had done, you see.
So they had been...
They'd been prisoners. They were prisoners, yes.
And they had appeared before you?
Yes.
To be classified?
As white, grey or black.
But how were you in a position to know how they should be classified?
One wasn't. It was all... Oh, gosh. One wasn't in a position to know, of course, but except from their own accounts. But from what I can remember, we had no blacks, and it was really only grey or white. And I think there were very few whites, because it was almost impossible for a Jawan to resist the persuading that the Japanese did. If they were white, they wouldn't be there, you know. And so I think most of them were grey, from what I can remember.
They'd just been coerced, you mean?
They'd just been coerced to join.
What, did you have any sympathy with them?
Oh, very much so. The Japanese were very clever and separated the officers from the men immediately, and the men were bewildered by what had happened, I should think very few of them wanted to be disloyal, which isn't the view, I don't think, that I saw a BBC commentary on it all, and it really bore no relationship to what actually happened at the time. But I think the people who were making it had made up their minds what happened before they actually had heard the facts.
What line did they take?
Oh, they took the line that it was a genuine movement of get rid of the Brits, you see, which I don't think there was at all. It's like the film Gandhi. You get the impression that everyone is terribly keen on freeing India. All the masses are anti-British, and all the British characters look second-rate actors, if you know what I mean. Whereas, in fact, it wasn't like that at all. You could walk quite freely in an Indian crowd and have everyone sort of appreciated you.
In what way appreciated you?
They were glad to see you, sort of thing. And I think it's borne out now still by our simply excellent relations with the Bengal Sappers. We're in constant touch with them, almost on a day-to-day business. They invite us out there, and when we go, we're made to feel we're worthwhile people.
So you were doing this job organising Demob at Roquet in 45.
Yes, it was a marvellous thing. We had the recruit. We had the people who were chosen for Demob. We had to spend an hour a day interviewing about 100 people, but we gradually chose the people, and then we put them through a fortnight's course. We decided that every man must know how to sign his own name in English script. We called it Roman Urdu. And every man had a sort of certain amount of schooling to do this. And then they spent another day or two. We had a boys' battalion, and they had a farm. And we taught them simple methods of irrigation, lifting water to different levels from a canal with a screw, you know, that kind of thing. And of course, we had to examine them that they were medically okay. And we had to fit them out with uniform. And the whole business took about a fortnight.
What happened to you next? Did you stay in India until independence?
No. My wife had gone home, and I was really staying there for no purpose. I'd been out for 7 years, and I decided to go home. And I was then posted... when I got home and after leave, I was posted as one sapper at the School of Infantry.